Hello, and welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast, the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. I'm your host, Bill Bant, and along with me on this journey revisiting 80s movies is my co-host, Jason Masick. Jason, I'd always thought we'd be friends forever.
Yeah, well, Bill, forever got a lot shorter all of a sudden.
That's right, listeners. We are discussing, with spoilers aplenty, the 1985 coming-of-age drama St. Elmo's Fire, distributed by Columbia Pictures. It stars Demi Moore, Rob Lowe, Judd Nelson, Ally Sheedy, Emilio Estevez, Andrew McCarthy, and Mae Whittingham. Directed by Joel Schumacher, this movie is rated R with a running time of 1 hour and 50 minutes. So, what is this movie about? What's on the box? If you grew up in the 1980s and went to your local video store to rent this movie, you would find this description on the back of the VHS box. It is What's on the Box. Take it away, Jason.
Today's hottest young actors star in this film about seven friends, recent college graduates, searching for a place in the real world as they face the issues of career and commitment. Leslie and Alec, Ally Sheedy and Judd Nelson, try to save a crumbling romance. Wendy, Mayor Whittingham, a shy virgin, hides a love for Billy, Rob Lowe, a reluctant father/husband still searching for goals. Kevin, Andrew McCarthy, is a cynical writer who scorns love until he realizes he's in love with his best friend's girl. Curbo, Emilio Estevez, a law student, obsessively pursues an older woman. The beautiful, neurotic Jules, Demi Moore, paints a poignant picture of life in the fast lane. Against the backdrop of St. Elmo's, their local hangout, they save, betray, and love one another as only the closest of friends can. St. Elmo's Fire.
St. Elmo's Fire. That was a short description considering everyone that's in this movie. You whipped through that one. So that was What's on the Box. Jason, how we doing?
Doing pretty good, Bill Bant. This is going to be a fun one. You ready to go back to 1985 to cover the Brat Pack?
Yeah, let us do that. What are your earliest memories of this movie?
Well, gee golly, Bill Bant. I know I didn't see this particular flick in the theater. Of course, I had seen these actors around the block in other films in the 80s, such as The Outsiders, The Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink, Mannequin from the Hip, Young Guns, Weekend at Bernie's, so on and so forth. Well, I came to this St. Elmo's Fire as a cable watch, definitely after 85, in the late 80s, early 90s, most likely. And I remembered enjoying it because I simply enjoyed these actors. I only wanted to see the hot young stars all together to see what they would do. Now, I've seen it more than a few times, and I remember always liking it. I remember the St. Elmo's bar, the camaraderie between best friends, Rob Lowe on the sax, or saxophone, as Bill Bant would call it. By the way, I played the saxophone in high school, and I didn't look nearly that good. I remember feeling embarrassed for Emilio Estevez as he pursues the older woman and Andy McDowell. I remember Demi Moore's drug issues in this film, Judd Nelson's douchiness, Andrew McCarthy's sweetness, and the innocence of the other actress, whose name I can never remember. Oh, yeah, Mayor Whittingham. She was a bit more conservative. And then I remember, of course, the overall coming-of-age relationship dramas that play out. Another early memory is that this movie has one of my favorite theme songs from an 80s film with Man in Motion, sung by the one and only John Parr. Now, me being a Springsteen fan in the mid to late 80s, I always loved the line that Judd Nelson delivers as the character Alec. No Springsteen is leaving this house. You can have all the Carly Simons. Always love that. I always liked this movie. An early memory would be that I never really had a critical take on it. I never looked at it as some kind of cinematic masterpiece, just a post-college slice of life movie about a group of best friends. And I remember it being sweet, sentimental, nostalgic, and a movie that happened to star the hottest actors at the time. So I was always down to watch St. Elmo's Fire. Those are my early memories. Bill Bant, what about you?
Yeah, for me, for this movie, it was certainly a rental. I know when this movie came out, this didn't seem to appeal to me because it seemed like young adults. And I was just barely, I wasn't even a freshman in high school. So it wasn't an action film, even though it had a couple of actors that I recognized. So I think like you, it was either late 80s or early 90s until I finally saw this movie. And then I was thinking about all the movies that starred this what they refer to as the Brat Pack, and I know you named off some of them before I even saw this, and it was Wisdom, One Crazy Summer, Blue City, Making the Grade, From the Hip, Billionaire Boys Club, Youngblood, About Last Night, Less Than Zero, Mannequin, Stakeout, That Was Then, This Is Now, Short Circuit, Miracle Mile. We still got a couple more years of this show because we got to get into all those. So it wasn't really until I probably saw all of them with all those people. And then I got older and I'm like, okay, this is closer to what is going to happen to me maybe post-college, that I finally found the movie to be in my wheelhouse and finally rented it. But for some reason, the scene that always just stands out to me was Demi Moore in the empty apartment.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
That's definitely the standout to me. It's certainly been a while since I saw it, but just having all those actors that I saw in so many other movies all together in the one, and like I said, too, the John Parr Man Emotion. Holy crap. I mean, even today, anytime you're on a radio station, they're doing 80s Weekend, this song is going to be played. And then even the main theme of St. Elmo's Fire, you hear that one all the time. That one, that really stands out. Not that much outside of that, to be honest. So it was good to just to kind of go back and watch it again, because maybe I've seen it like 2 or 3 times before watching it again for this podcast. So it was kind of cool to see this again, because I equated it to A Breakfast Club or The Big Chill, just to see how much it might be similar, or even if that one holds up. Because I know for me, I did like The Big Chill when we discussed in the episode. The Breakfast Club, not as much. The Breakfast Club was great at the time, but I just didn't think it stood the test of time. I think that's a movie that I'd love for them to somehow revisit. So going into St. Elmo's Fire, I was wondering if that was going to be the same way.
Good call. Yeah, great stuff. Great list of movies you rattled off there. Youngblood, Rob Lowe. That's the hockey movie, right?
Yes.
Great stuff. I did not discover Miracle Mile until I was going over Mayor Winningham's filmography, which I'll get into in a little bit, actually.
That was one. It just happened to be on because, like, high school, the weekends, I'd be up to like 2 or 3 in the morning, and that just happened to be playing.
Yeah.
And I think the first time I watched it, I caught it. I think I missed the first 15 minutes, so I wasn't even sure what the thing was about, but because of Anthony Edwards, I just started watching it, and I was like, wait, what the hell is this? So I had to go find it again to watch from the beginning to really understand what the hell was going on.
We should just go back and do a whole Anthony Edwards series. I need to revisit all of his films, apparently.
Yeah.
Great stuff. But Mayor Winningham, the great Mayor Winningham. Yeah,
that's a sad absolutely. One.
Hmm. Great stuff, man. Thinking about, I agree with you, like with the Breakfast Club, because the same year, 1985, the fact that Breakfast Club and St. Elmo's Fire came out in the same year is kind of crazy. So
right. Especially when you have two of the actors in both. Well, three. Yeah. Three. Sorry.
And to step on trivia right away, many people may be aware of this, but obviously the cast is playing high school characters in The Breakfast Club, and then in a movie released the same year, now they're post-college. They haven't aged that much.
Yep.
We went with it. We went with it in the 80s. Are we ready to start talking about St. Elmo's Fire?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So here it is. This is the film which, after its release, is known for, along with The Breakfast Club, having spawned the iconic moniker, The Brat Pack, to describe these famous young stars, give or take a few. We, of course, know that originally there was The Rat Pack, which was mainly composed of classic actors and musicians from the 50s and 60s, such as Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, and Joey Bishop. Now, obviously, The Brat Pack is a spin on that moniker. We may get more into this in our fun facts and trivia, but the name Brat Pack was coined by writer David Blum in an article he wrote for the New York Magazine in 1985 after the premiere of St. Elmo's Fire, and it was about this group of hot young actors dealing with their fame. Now, the group is now known not only to include the casts of The Breakfast Club and St. Elmo's Fire, but may or may not include the likes of James Spader and Robert Downey Jr., among others, and the group usually leaves actress Mayor Winningham off the list because she was never in another film outside of St. Elmo's Fire with these cast members. So that's it in a nutshell. Again, more detail to come later. Now, speaking of Mayor Winningham, this is what I thought. Here's an initial thought. Mayor Winningham is to St. Elmo's Fire as Mary Kay Place is to The Big Chill. That's my take. That's my opinion. So I just thought I'd give Mayor Winningham some love right now, right here. She plays the role of Wendy Beamish. Some light on her filmography here. In the 80s, she started off with roles in TV movies. She did a couple episodes of The Thornbirds in 83. She does this in 85. She was in other films such as Nobody's Fool in 86, Shy People and Made in Heaven, both in 87. We mentioned Miracle Mile, which was released in 88, Turner and Hooch in 89. Other notables for me, she plays the role of Maddie Blaylock in Wyatt Earp in 1994. She generally does a ton, and I mean a ton of work in TV movies and episodic TV, being on every show you can imagine throughout the 2000s. Recently, she was in the HBO series The Outsider in 2020. She was in the movie News of the World with Tom Hanks in 2020. And most recently, she was in the acclaimed miniseries Dopesick as the mother of a daughter addicted to opioids. She's excellent in that. Saw that one. Great, great stuff. Pretty heavy. So not to worry, Mary Winningham has been winning as she's been working this entire time. She's now 64 and still kicking butt. Here's another initial thought. We all know that John Parr song, Man in Motion, and Bill Bant already said it. Just as identifiable is that St. Elmo's Fire love theme from David Foster, who composed the score for this movie. You just hear those strings at the very top of this movie, and it's instantly nostalgic. Just like other great themes from the 80s, it takes you back to this time period, and in particular, it makes you think of this movie, but also our friends during that coming of age period when Bill and I were in high school ourselves. Okay, so I was doing some loose research and getting started with my notes on St. Elmo's Fire, and I couldn't help but notice that this film received some mixed to negative critical reviews when it was released, thus really interested in this revisit to see how was I going to receive this movie today as an adult. And I gotta tell you, Bill Bant and listeners, my perception of this movie is a whole lot different today. Let's just start with the good. The movie obviously has its electric stars. They're all undeniable and have a real presence and vibrance and a wonderful dynamic with one another on screen. I believe they're all best friends. They have their inside jokes, their ways of mocking one another, and their group chant. They hold a bugga 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 ha ha ha, something like that. And it's fun. We can clearly see their connection and bond. They're best friends that just graduated from Georgetown University, and now they're experiencing real life together while living in Georgetown, Washington, D.C., and they're young, they're beautiful, they're wild, they're free, they've got great jobs. Well, most of them, not Billy. And their whole future is in front of them. There you go. It's fun. Let them be wild. I like watching it, absolutely. But, and here comes the but, this movie has almost no substance. It has plenty of substances, but not a lot of substance itself. And I have to be honest, for me, Bill Bant, 4 out of the 7 main protagonists are totally unlikable, in my opinion. And I hate saying it. Here's my take. Kirby, he's an obsessed stalker who's borderline psycho. Just totally immature. Alex, cheating, pretentious douchebag. Jules is a drug addict who's desperate for attention and obviously crying for help. Billy technically has a wife that he cheats on and a child he's abandoned and is a playboy who parties, can't hold down a job, is overly aggressive sexually, almost to the point of criminality. Some might argue to the point of criminality, but yet he's a talented saxophone player and apparently carries that saxophone around with him everywhere, and everybody loves him for it. As for the other three protagonists, there's Kevin, who is a cynical writer, and he's cynical about love, but generally innocuous. There's Leslie, who's trying to avoid being pressured into getting married by Alec, and I'm not sure what else she's doing in this movie. But there's then Wendy, played by Mary Winningham, who's just trying to pave her own path and make her own way as an individual apart from her family's business. Okay, so those three characters are fine, I guess. I actually thought that Ally Sheedy was kind of a standout for me. I liked her performance in this. She's pretty damn adorable. Although I know nothing about her character, I think in my research, I saw she's an architecture student, or was, and is in now architecture. Great. I think we see her working on a draft table at one point in her new apartment she's moved into with Alec, and that's all I got for her character. Look, there is some character setup here that could make for real drama, but it barely scratches the surface. And although some of these characters' choices and actions are questionable, I'm not sure there's any consequences in this movie. There's some discussion of consequences, but no consequences dealt with. There's some tough things that happen, but everybody forgives one another very quickly because in the end, aren't we all just supposed to be friends? And we just watch them fumble around a bit while falling in and out of love with one another and all the while drinking and smoking a shit ton in this movie. Look, again, this is the 80s. I get it. Excess, beautiful young white people trying to figure things out. Yeah, there's the uppie culture. And this movie is not supposed to be Lawrence of Arabia, but things are really super superficial for an almost 2-hour movie. The material at its core is just not that interesting to me. As an adult, that's my opinion. If it's going to be a romp, then make it a romp. If you're going to have heavier real life elements to this and to these characters, there has to be real life consequences. In the end, I was like, no. You know what I was thinking? You mentioned Less Than Zero, Bill Bant. I thought that was a little bit better version of this, albeit much darker, but there's some real consequences in that movie. That's a tough one. Now, I don't want to hate on it too much, but it was one thing as a high school kid watching this, or maybe early college version of myself watching this with very little responsibility myself at the time and a carefree attitude, versus watching this as an adult who's made some mistake in his life. And now viewing this is just putting pretty people on display, clearly staging them actually to a certain extent, while splashing in some 80s sex, drugs, and rock and roll. No clear through line, not a lot to take away from the movie, except that in your youth, I guess you can fuck up a lot, and it's okay as long as you have money and your best friends who forgive you no matter what. Is that too harsh? I don't know. I was thinking about The Big Chill a lot as well. Obviously, we love that movie on this podcast. Seemed to be a lot more going on, a little deeper movie there, character development, etc. Anyway, I used to think this was a fun movie, but it sort of got flipped on me on this revisit. That's just my honest opinion, guys, ladies and gents. Lastly, is it weird that I found the brief scenes between the prostitute and Andrew McCarthy the most heartwarming? I think that might say a lot. Those are my initial thoughts, Bill Bant. What about you, my friend?
Jason, did you hack my computer and steal my notes? Because all I need to say is ditto. I almost agree with you 100% on everything that you said. I think it's just a different perspective being an adult, because we go back to when we finished college in our early 20s. And yes, you do stupid things because it's your first time, you're out on your own. You're trying to find your way. So I get that. But watching this movie, it was so hard to try to latch on to a character or storyline because everybody was just doing something so stupid or too one note for me.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, there's no real consequences at the end. It's they kind of go their separate ways and that's it. I don't know. So everything you said, I totally agree with you. I tried to come up with a little exercise. I watched this 3 times. It was interesting. I liked all the actors in it. The performances were fine. It goes by really quick, but story-wise, writing-wise, it was a hot mess.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, if I were to make this today or make it better, what would I do? And instead of doing that, I was like, you know what? If the creators of Friends watch this movie,
yep,
I saw so many parallels between the two. Okay, let's take St. Elmo's Fire. Instead of making a bar, let's make it a coffee shop, Central Perk. That's where all our characters are going to meet. So we have too many people with 7, so we'll cut it down to 6. Okay, sounds good. All right, Alec and Leslie, all right, you're going to become Ross and Rachel. Couple's going to have issues. One of them is going to end up cheating. They'll break up, but we'll eventually bring them back together. Then Billy, you know what? Let's make that Joey. Instead of making a saxophone player, let's make him an actor. Make him a little more lovable dumb. Not so much a dick like Billy is. Okay, we got 3 characters done. Let's take Kevin and Kirby, mix them up into 1 character. Make it Chandler. Give him a little more comic relief. You know, the guy's always pining for the girl. Never seems to get it. Love life is always a mess. There you go. But then, you know, he eventually gets Monica at the end. Wendy, I kind of made Monica, but just make her a little more self-assertive and attractive.
Mm.
So that leaves Jules as kind of a Phoebe. All right, she's not going to have the drug problem. So there's not that much parallel between, I think, Jules and Phoebe. But yeah, this is really almost taking that movie and fixing it and then making it into a hit TV show for, I think it was 10 seasons.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of saw watching this. I would love to meet the creators and say, come on, St. Elmo's Fire had some influence on this, didn't it? Outside of that, everything that you said, I totally agree with. It was kind of a shock watching this and being like, ooh, yeah, this is definitely one that does not hold up like I thought it would, but it was still interesting enough to watch. Yeah, I think it's kind of crap, but it's like a fun crap, if that makes sense.
Oh, that's great stuff, man. The comp to the sitcom and the stock characters in a sitcom is spot on. I thought the exact same thing. you have this group of characters, you put them in St. Elmo's Bar, make it a coffee shop, it's Friends, make it Cheers, it's Cheers.
Right.
The you know,
yeah, that's what I was thinking, is like, they can't do Cheers.
Right.
Can't do it in a bar because it's already been done. So where can we set this at? Let's do a coffee shop instead.
Absolutely. And this is a matter of semantics. The word, because I actually found that this movie held my attention. I wasn't involved in the story. I didn't care as much about what was going on with these people because they were making very poor choices and dangerous choices, and there was no culpability, etc., accountability. So I did not care about them, but it still holds your attention simply because of these actors, these cast members.
That's a great way to put it. Holds your attention.
Because it's well cast. These were stars for a reason, and they shine when they're on screen. Rob Lowe is gorgeous. Emilio Estevez just exudes this youthfulness and vibrance, and he's jumping off the screen. I said Ali Sheedy is beautiful and adorable and all those things, and just has a great laugh. And Andrew McCarthy pulls off this sort of sweetness guy next door that you just can't help but want to be friends with. So it's in and on and on and on. I'm going to go through every cast member, but Judd Nelson just nails the douchiness. So you just, yeah, I get these guys. I know these actors. I've seen them in other movies. We're going to throw this mix of these actors together. Let's see what this recipe looks like or tastes like. But this didn't work because just too superficial for me. Anyway, still fun to see them again, but different watching it as an adult.
Yeah, I think I was more interested to see how many times they would throw in the John Parr song or the instrumental theme throughout the movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
What a great theme song, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Both of those songs, yep.
Let's move on to favorite scenes or moments.
Let's do it.
I'll be honest, this was a struggle, just because every scene or moment in this movie would almost make me scream at the scene because they would just do something so dumb or it would just kill the scene for me. So the first thing I came up with for me was actually the almost opening. And that's how we get all the characters back together. So the very beginning of the film, it opens up with our seven protagonists coming out of college. They've just graduated and they're all together.
Gowns and caps on.
Like shoulder to shoulder and just walking towards the screen, and then shows the title. And then we hear a car accident and we find out that Wendy and Billy have been in a car accident. And our other five protagonists show up to the hospital to check on them. And you get a kind of a quick glimpse of who they are. We know Judd Nelson, who plays Alec, works for a senator. And you can just see by the way that Emilio Estevez is dressed as Kirby, that he's probably working at some kind of bar or restaurant. We meet Jules, and she's all decked out, and this guy in a suit, and the other friends make fun of her, like, oh, that's your date of the week. So, you know, she's kind of like a partier and always got new boyfriends and stuff like that. We meet Allie. She plays Leslie. We kind of figure out, okay, Leslie and Alec are together. Then we meet Kevin, who's played by Andrew McCarthy. And he's kind of like the wisecracker at that point, too. So you're like, oh, okay, so he might be the comic relief. But then we find out, yeah, he's kind of more of a Debbie Downer on love and all that kind of stuff. So I didn't necessarily like how the scene plays out, but I liked how they brought everyone together in the scene and how that all jump starts from this moment. And then we find out Billy's the one that got in the accident, but Wendy's paying the bill for them to take care of, and Billy gets arrested. And he doesn't really seem to care that he's getting arrested, or doesn't even seem that concerned about Wendy. It's like, wow, that's a douche move. And we find out that Billy just wrecked Wendy's brand new car. So it's just like, damn, this guy's kind of a dick. But they all seem to be really close friends. And they're already talking about, Jesus, you know, it's been 4 months since they've graduated. And Billy's just been fucking up almost, it seems like, every week since this has happened. So it kind of sets some things in motion. You get a quick little sampling of maybe who all the characters are and what they're going to be about. But I just like the setup of how they just brought everyone together and how it goes from there. Because then they go from there and end up at St. Elmo's Fire for the first time.
Absolutely. It is a good way to start things off. I totally agree with that aspect of the scene. And the one thing I was thinking about while you were breaking it down is that I do believe the film does a good job of making us believe that they're friends, that they are there for one another, that they're so tightly connected. The fact that they all show up to the hospital to check on Billy and Wendy, to make sure they're okay. They fear the worst at first, but Alec approaches a police officer to get some information, and also we get an idea of who he is, and we see how they care for one another. And then when Wendy comes out and she's got a scratch on her head, she has a bandage on her forehead from the accident, and she's paying what it seems to be the hospital bill, I guess. And we understand that she's in some sort of relationship that is based on obsession, it seems. Well, it's made very clear shortly thereafter. That's exactly what it is. She's in this relationship with Billy. And it's a smart way to do it that flows relatively smoothly and quickly. It's well done. It's smart. And it's usually something I point out in other films that do it really well. And I did appreciate the first part of this sequence when we just meet our characters and we understand, oh, okay, wow, they all came to the hospital separately. It's not they all piled in a car and got there. They all kind of show up for one another. They're there for one another, and that it's a good way to go, okay, I understand the dynamic here. Well done. So that works. Absolutely.
What do you got for a scene or moment?
So I'm going to go with part of a scene, which I'm just calling Billy and Wendy on the roof. We just talked about Billy and Wendy's relationship briefly here. There's a very, very solid understanding of the fact that Wendy, whom we know, she's a social worker. She works in the welfare office there in Georgetown, and she likes what she does. She's not making a ton of money, but she finds value in her job, and she has a certain amount of self-worth, but she's been caught in this pattern of a relationship that she has with Billy. No matter what he does, no matter what mistakes he makes or how he treats her or how poorly he treats her, she's going to be there for him. She's going to pay for him. She's going to vie for his affections. She's going to do whatever it takes because she's obsessed. And they've been friends for so long. There's just a really strong foundation between the two of them. And you get the sense that Billy appreciates Wendy on a certain level, but is also taking advantage of her. And it's not good. Does not paint him in a good light. It's a matter of respect. And he's not being honest with himself as far as how he's treating her. This is kind of I'll just jump to my additional questions right now, is trying to define this relationship. We know certain things about where Wendy's coming from, but are they dating? Are they together? Are they not together? But we understand that they're seeing one another, and they're not really boyfriend, girlfriend, because Billy's has a marriage he's still trying to, I guess, hold on to, and a daughter, et cetera. And it's very confusing as to what the relationship is, which makes sense why they're always kind of in a purgatory. There's no real boundaries to this relationship. So at this particular time in the movie, Wendy has now invited Billy over to her house for dinner. And it establishes this fact that Wendy's family works in the card business, and they own several franchises. All the family members, whether it be brother, sister, well, her parents, her father, I think in particular, had started this business, and they've done very well. It's a very nice home that they live in, and now they're having a big family dinner, and Wendy has invited Billy over. I have some questions as to how Billy is even allowed in the house at this point, because he's trashed her father's car in that opening scene. So it's like, okay, well, I guess that's forgiven. Maybe Wendy lied to her dad about that. We don't know. However, there's some fun moments when they're at dinner and we understand where Wendy comes from and her family. But there's a nice scene when all of a sudden somebody, I believe it's one of the kids, that screams out, oh my God, Billy's on the roof, as if something dangerous is occurring. And then it cuts to Billy Hicks. Rob Lowe is sitting up on the roof. I think he's finishing off a glass of whiskey or bourbon or something of the like and having a smoke, just taking in the night sky and the fresh air. And Wendy goes up to join him. She doesn't go out onto the roof, but she's looking through the windowsill. And this is a moment of quiet in the film that I appreciate. It's a moment of vulnerability and honesty from Billy, which up to this point, he just seems, what did they call it, a man child, and hasn't been able to let go of his college years, and he's full of shit, and he sleeps around, and he has no boundaries, no values whatsoever, and he's in this nebulous relationship with Wendy. But at this point, he's actually saying what's really on his mind and coming from the inside. And when Wendy's leaning out of the windowsill, she looks at Billy and says, "You miss school, don't you?" And he says, "Yeah, you know, school is pretty out of hand. In everyday life, there's just no way to be out of hand. You got to be so..." And then he looks over the edge of the roof and he says, "You know, if it ever got to be too much, like too much." And he alludes to jumping off the roof, which is pretty heavy. It's like contemplating the possibility of suicide. And he almost falls over because he's clumsy for being so drunk. And Wendy is like, "Well, that's out of hand. Jesus." And he responds with, "Don't you ever think about it?" And she says, "Not while I'm still a virgin." And Billy responds with, "Why didn't you ever tell me that before?" And she said, "I don't know." And Billy responds with, "Come on, I mean, all those guys you went out with, well, Stewie Newman." And she has this funny line with, "Oh, please, would you do it with Stewie Newman?" Well, so there's a brief exchange here that is honest, and you understand they are close enough to have this kind of conversation. And I liked it because it was like, okay, Billy's a real human being at heart. He's got feelings and some dark thoughts and some things that he's dealing with and processing. It's not all on the surface. And we understand that Wendy is a virgin and she's a little bit more on the conservative side. And she's just so in love with Billy and wants to take care of him. And it's kind of a messed up relationship. So I appreciate that scene. I won't go further than that because afterward, unfortunately, in Billy's drunken stupor, now he's trying to take things to the next level. And she wants to go there. She, I think, invites the intimacy, but he takes it too far. And he basically begins groping Wendy and she has to pull away and it ends badly. And it's one of those scenes again, where we're just like, well, this guy's just an asshole. He's a loser asshole. But for a moment here, I like the scene because he's not an asshole. So that's my first sort of favorite scene.
That whole Wendy Billy dynamic made no sense to me. Like, I get that Wendy could be obsessed with Billy. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. We understand
but
that.
But she knows he is married. He has a kid. He hits on anything with two legs and moves. He's a fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
And I get it. Sometimes you just can't help your feelings. But she seems responsible enough that she should know there's no way I should ever act on this. And Billy, he's got issues. And yeah, he's a man child. Why he's pseudo obsessed with Wendy makes no sense to me. Is it just he just wants to be the one that, you know, she loses her virginity to? So it's more of a contest. And then that's so wrong. And that kind of pisses me off. I just kept yelling at Wendy. I'm like, "Wendy, come on, snap out of it." After that scene where she kind of says, "I'm done with you." Mm-hmm. And then goes out with that other guy.
Right.
And yeah, he's not nice guy. Nice guy. We'll just put it that way. Nice guy.
Very nice guy. Yeah, the antithesis of Billy. Yeah.
Correct. But you would think as a friend, like, just stay away from that. You never get that moment where the friend's like, just stay away from him. He's issues. He's married. He keeps trying to save his marriage.
There's a brief scene earlier on in the bathroom, I think, when Leslie and Jules give Wendy a little bit of a, like, "Why are you doing this? Why do you stay with him? You need to end it," kind of thing. But it's so brief. It's just there's a perpetual cycle that's happening here. I understand it. I've been in tumultuous relationships. I understand obsession. I've been there. I've been the one obsessed. It's not a good feeling. It's something that you feel you have no control over. There's always this weird sort of hope that you think the other person will change or something magically will happen where you both become this perfect fit for one another, emotionally, mentally, physically, whatever it might be. And it just never happens, but you still hold on to this hope. And from his point of view, you're right. I mean, he's really taking advantage of the fact that she takes care of him. He knows she's obsessed with him. He has full knowledge of that. And she will pay for him, for his rent, for the drinks, for the going out, the being together, whatever it might be. So it's pretty wicked, that sort of cycle of within that kind of obsess-filled relationship. Anyway.
Right. I think if Billy wasn't married with a newborn, I would have let it slide a little more.
Yes, I totally agree, because no one's innocent in this. She is very responsible for what her actions as well. She knows who he is. It's not like she's being taken advantage of blindly.
Yeah.
Anyway, got off on a tangent there because it's a that's a tough relationship to watch
yes.
in the movie. One, because we, again, like these actors, and Mayor Winningham appears so innocent and sweet, and Rob Lowe's just a cool guy you kind of want to pull for. If I recall, like when I'd seen him before, he doesn't come off dickish. But in this film, he's not a good guy.
No, not at all. Not at all.
You hate to hate Rob Lowe. I don't want to hate him. Anyway, the stuff on the roof I liked. Get back to the good stuff.
Yeah, I actually should have put that as earliest memories outside of the Demi Moore in the apartment. That is a memorable, just him just being on the roof.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. In addition to that scene with Demi Moore, you're
saying? Yeah, that's the two that really stand out.
Sure. I agree.
Images, per se.
Yeah. What do you got next, man, for favorite scene or moment?
Well, I think it's something that we both had. So we have Kevin, played by Andrew McCarthy. And all throughout this movie, he basically poo-poos love. But we really find out that he has a thing for Leslie, Alex's girlfriend. And Alex has been trying to get engaged to her. And Leslie's played by Ally Sheedy. So Kevin's really been pining for her. And he's got the tunnel vision. And there's no love outside of him and maybe Leslie getting together. So in the meantime, to everyone else, love stinks, love sucks. Even when he's around Leslie, he's still like Debbie Downer with the whole love thing, instead of maybe possibly dropping hints. Because Leslie's not even sure with herself and Alec. She thinks the relationship's moving too fast. So just to kind of set that up, when Kevin goes home, he's not in the best of neighborhoods. And we have a prostitute that hangs out there by the name of Naomi. And Naomi's working the street, and she's always trying to get her tricks. And just a really weird thing that Kevin all of a sudden kind of feels jealous that Naomi never asks Kevin for a date. So yeah. Kevin actually goes up to her and says, "How come you never asked me if I want a date?" And Naomi comes back with, "I thought you were gay." And Kevin responds, "What? Why would you think I'm gay? Because I never see you around with any girls. And you always look strange." And then Kevin does the whole thing like, "I do like someone, and this person just doesn't know it." And I thought it was kind of weird, but I just like the interactions between Kevin and Naomi. And then they meet again in another scene. And once again, now that Naomi knows that Kevin does like girls, she propositions him. And at one point, Kevin comes back with, because she kind of says, "For $50, I'll take care of you and show you what love is." And Kevin comes back with, "I don't pay for sex." And Naomi goes, "Oh, no." And Kevin's like, "No." And Naomi said, and I think I've always thought of this because of the scene. You think that if you get a little wife or a girlfriend that you don't pay, you pay. And then you never be sure you're going to get it. Now with Naomi, and Kevin responds Naomi because he never knew what her name was. Naomi says, "Yeah, you pay. And you get it. Oh, you get it good." And Kevin walks off saying, "Food for thought, food for thought." And I always joke thinking about what Naomi's saying is true, because when you're in a relationship, you pay for dates and stuff like that. So in a sense, yeah, you do kind of pay, but not in an illegal sense where you pay, solicit someone to have sexual relationships with you. But I always thought that was kind of funny, because I'm like, oh yeah, Naomi's kind of right. You do pay in some regards or another. I mean, it's weird that they're kind of talking, but I just kind of found some honesty in those conversations. And Naomi's like the one character I was just kind of like, outside of being a prostitute, I was like, hey, she's a straight up shooter.
Yeah.
She seemed kind of real to me.
Look, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm so glad that we're on the same page with this. These two brief scenes between Kevin and Naomi, I was like, here's real chemistry. These are the most interesting scenes. And I also want to just take a step back and saying, obviously, I have some negative criticism about this film overall. And one of the reasons being that there is this shine on it. There's this sheen of these pretty young actors having a lot of fun drinking, smoking, partying, doing whatever they want, living their best lives in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. There's a lot of sexiness and gloss to it, what's lacking is the substance. And that's why I think we're calling out these moments of honesty and vulnerability, because in a coming of age film, we do initially watch it for these young actors, some great music, you know, like I'm just thinking of like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, right away, where it's just a fun scenario that they're placed in. But then because it's a coming of age movie, we want to see them come of age. We want to see these either learning moments, teachable moments, epiphany moments where these characters learn something. And then the message kind of comes through that, which I felt was sort of overall just lacking from this particular movie. So there's a lot of fun to be had on the surface of this. It's just we may get a little bit down in the doldrums here with the subject matter, because watching it now, we're like, oh, there's some dark shit in this. But funny enough, you would think that this particular brief scene would be darker, where it's at night and it's gritty, you know, as Kevin's going to his apartment, which is, again, like Bill said, not in the best part of the town. And now he's going to have the balls to approach a prostitute, which I know as a kid would be like, oh, man, I'd never go talk to a prostitute and just walk up to a prostitute on the street. I would do everything I could to avoid it. So watching it, it's interesting today. You're like, wow, good for you, Kevin. You've got nothing to be afraid of. Go bend the ear. Go talk to Naomi. See what she's got to say. And not only that, this is an opportunity to receive some street level advice for someone that works on the street. And obviously this woman, Naomi, has a little more experience. I think there's actually a missed opportunity here, because there could have been another scene with between them two, or maybe he actually asks her to back to his apartment, says, you know what? I'm going to pay you $50, but not for sex. I need just life advice, you know, basically like, let's go back inside and just talk for a while. Like, that seems like Kevin would do that. His character would actually do that, because she's got real world experience. And so I was like, man, it just was interesting watching their back and forth. It just seemed those actors had a real connection. And again, I think there's a missed bet here. I think there could have been more within these scenes. It doesn't need to be too long, but just the fact that she talks about, you know, when you get in a relationship, you're still paying for it. Talking about secrets, there's a bit about that in one of the scenes. Everybody's got secrets, and obviously she knows better than anyone that a lot of her tricks have a lot of secrets. So there's things to be learned within these small scenes. But I thought, last thing I'll say is I'm going to give some credit here to Anna Maria Horsford, who plays Naomi. She's great. And thanks to her, the scene works, because she plays the role of a prostitute. She still has a job to perform, and she's selling sex and she's selling herself, and she does it quite well, but she still has a moment of connection with Andrew McCarthy. They're looking at each other in the eye, having a little bit of real conversation in between the sales that she's trying to perform. And so, yeah, shout out to Anna Maria Horsford. She's great.
Yeah. 'Cause when they meet the second time, you almost feel like, oh, yeah, he's going to put out $50.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's what I was going to say. Yeah, that it could actually happen.
Yeah, pretty impressive sell.
Right.
All right, what else do you have for a moment or scene?
Well, I'm going to jump to the almost very end, actually. And again, we're just touching on scenes that have the, let's have a heart-to-heart talk. Let's have some honesty and kind of a what did I learn moment. And now we see Wendy, she has managed to escape the pressures of her family to get into the family business. And she continues with her work in welfare and as a social worker. And she's gotten her new apartment and she's establishing herself. And she's, I believe, painting the walls in her new apartment. And Billy happens to be there. And Billy starts talking, saying that he realizes he can't be like Alec. And we know it throughout the film, Alec was trying to find work for Billy, but Billy couldn't hold down any of those jobs. Well, Billy realizes he can't really stick around because he can't be part of this post-college life. He's too drawn to the actual college life he lived, and he's not really cut out for careers and marriage. And he decides that actually his ex-wife and baby girl would be better off without him because, well, she's about to get remarried soon. And he actually ends up paying Wendy some of the rent he owed her. I'm still confused as to what.
I think because he's borrowed so much money from Wendy that he decided to at least try to give some of it back. And said he would try to pay everything in full.
So he says he's going to New York, and it's a little bittersweet here because there's going to be a separation now that, you know, one of the friends is leaving the pack and Billy has to go find his own path, and he's going to go to New York and find his own way, hopefully. And it seems in this scene that he, at least for the moment, is clean and sober. He's cleaned up his act a little bit and had some sort of realization that he's made some real mistakes and he's got to make a change for sure. Now, what's also very prominent in the scene is the fact that Wendy's, she's found herself. She's proud of herself. She's taking ownership. She is taking real pride in that. And she has her own refrigerator. She has her own furniture, and she can go into her own refrigerator, and she has her own bread that she bought and her own peanut butter and jelly, and she can make a sandwich that she earned and that she owns. And she talks about the fact that she eats this sandwich that she had, she made her first PB&J at her new apartment, and it was the best PB&J she ever had in her entire life. It's again one of these moments where it's like, okay, this is now coming of age. They have come of age. They've learned something. They're moving forward. And these are real people expressing these real moments where they've grown up. That's a moment. It's a growing up. They're adulting, if you will, pointing out those specific moments when they realized, I have to be an adult now. I have to make a change. So I appreciated that about this scene. What about you, Bill?
Yeah, I did like the peanut butter and jelly speech, just because all throughout the movie, Wendy wants to get out of her parents' home, but her parents don't think she should leave until she gets married. And of course, they have differing opinions on that. And she eventually is able to get out of the house on her own. And I think it's just that freedom that she's able to express and be on her own, and fact that she makes a peanut butter sandwich when she wants with all of her stuff, that becomes the greatest peanut butter and jelly sandwich ever. It's just the freedom aspect of it. It's not that it was the best sandwich. It was just the fact that mom wasn't making it for her. She was using her money that she earned. There is something cool about going out on your own and having your own place and being able to do your own thing, shop for your own food. And yeah, there's things that suck too. It's like, now I got to do my own laundry. You know, I got to clean my place, but she's at least taking a positive approach to things that were done for her in the past that now she could do on her own without the shadow of her parents. So it made me think of when I finally moved out to my own place and bought my own food and cooked my own dinners and that kind of thing. So I did enjoy that little moment, the peanut butter and jelly speech.
And Mary Winningham is great in that moment. And it's a totally relatable moment, but I'm glad you said the word freedom, because that's really what it is. She's free to make her own choices, and good or bad. And throughout the movie, we've seen people telling her what to do, whether it's her father or her friends, who you should be in love with, what career you should be pursuing. And instead, she has her own life, and she makes a choice to make her own life and stand up for herself. And that's what she does in this moment. But then it goes, again, sour after that moment, in my opinion. And that's where I say our favorite scene, if I may speak for you as well, Bill Bandt. The favorite scene part is over after the PB&J speech.
Correct.
Pretty much. Because for those of you that have seen the film, what happens after this is that, I'm cutting to the chase, Billy asks her once again if she's still a virgin and completely ruins the moment. They were having this nice heart-to-heart talk about the realizations that they've made in their lives in this growing up moment, and basically says to her, I wish I had written this down, the quote.
Will you do me this one final favor?
Yeah. Yeah. Meaning, will you sleep with me? He frames it as if she's going to be doing him a favor and totally manipulates the situation to get her to sleep with him, which she does.
I know.
And it's like, oh, not cool, man. Not cool. He flipped it versus hitting on her or trying to kiss her and make a pass at her, grope her, which he did in the previous sequence in the middle of the movie. At this point, at the end, he flips it and acts as if he is now this super vulnerable one and is going to miss her because he's about to leave.
and that she's going to be doing him a favor by sleeping with him. And it's like, oh, you manipulative bastard.
Yeah.
Wow.
That pissed me off. I said, Wendy, you better be going to the clinic the next day.
Totally. Billy Hicks and his saxophone.
Yeah, let's move on to Swiss Cheese, the complaint department. And why do we call it Swiss Cheese?
Because although this movie is delicious, it does have alcohol guzzling and cigarette smoking mouth holes.
Yes, and if it doesn't have any of those holes, we just file a complaint with the complaint department. All right, we already started a little bit with Billy sleeping with Wendy. What else do we have for Swiss Cheese complaints?
All right.
It might be a lot.
We're going to beat up on St. Elmo's bar for a little bit. Overall, I mentioned the movie has no stakes or consequences and lacks substance. Secondly, four of the seven protagonists aren't likable. Covered that. All right. That whole beginning sequence, that opening shot is fine with the seven of them, very staged, but it's cool watching the seven actors all together in their graduation caps and gowns walking toward the camera. Nice moments. We hear the audio of the car crash. We get to the hospital. Nice establishment of character. It's great. But and we get to know that Wendy has been slightly hurt in this car accident with Billy. Billy happened to be drunk driving. Not only was he driving her dad's car drunk and total it, he is still hanging out back of the hospital or emergency room, flirting with the nurse and playing his saxophone in the ambulance. And he's cracking jokes. Billy actually is then arrested for drunk driving, still making wisecracks, doesn't take it seriously at all. And what it seems like to be only a couple of hours, maybe later, his friends have bailed him out. They all pile into Alex's car and they go straight to the bar. Billy was just arrested for drunk driving and they take him and Wendy to the bar. And I was like, holy shit, what are you guys doing? Are you serious? Is anyone accountable for their actions or their enabling? Then we get to the bar. All's well. They're having fun. More character establishment. And now we know that Wendy is obsessed with the beautiful drunk Billy that just totaled her dad's car. Billy's already hitting someone else at the bar. We learn that he's lost his job that day, that Alec had gotten him. There's a brief argument then between Alec and Billy in the bathroom, withdraws all the pals together for some reason. They all will go run. Well, they're all besties and they all just run into the bathroom to support one another. And Alec, in his frustration with Billy, dunks him in the toilet. Billy gets out and is like, oh, well, the wet look is still in, so I'm good. Making jokes. They all make up together, do their little bugada 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 ha 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 thing, and they get back to drinking. And that kind of sums up the movie for me. That's like, there's a microcosm of the movie. No real stakes or consequences. Everybody's just fucking off doing whatever they want. And such is life, right? When you're young and you can get away with this stuff, I guess. The opening sequence from the second half of that hospital scene into St. Elmo's bar. Don't get me wrong. There's some fun, lighthearted, quippy moments. But overall, you're like, holy shit, this is problematic. There's some unhealthy behavior happening here. And I don't mean, like, we're all kids. We all drink too much. You smoke too much. You do drugs, whatever it might be, recreationally, and you have best friends. That's fine. I'm talking about the drunk driving and the cheating and the you better call your wife and losing your job and stuff. That's some of it gets into some deeper stuff that's just not dealt with.
Right. Billy's caught drunk driving. He admits to the officer he was drunk driving. And then that's it. No consequences. We don't hear anything about it like, hey, Billy, you know, you have a court date. Nothing like him blowing that off or possibly getting arrested. Nothing. And then the second thing. Now, Jason, you and I have known each other for 30 plus years.
Yeah.
If I dunked your head in the toilet, do you think this show would still be going on? Do you think we'd be talking to each other?
Maybe if you dunked my head in the toilet back in college, I may have gotten over it by now. But no, not immediately thereafter. No.
I guess it would depend on what toilet it was. Because if it's in a public place like that.
Oh, my God.
I almost threw up. No way.
Here's another complaint I had just real quick. speaking of St. Elmo's Bar, because we know now that Kirby, aka Kerbo, played by Emilio Estevez, works at St. Elmo's Bar. He's a server. He wouldn't have lasted a second working at that bar. No fucking way. And I say that F word in there, ladies and gents, because I've been in the customer service industry for 20 plus years, and we get the character of Wally, who seems to be the owner of the bar, I'm assuming, yell at Kirby a little bit, and they make a joke about firing him. But at best, you see Kirby walk around with a tray in the movie with one empty mug of beer. That place is packed and going off. And shout out to all the cocktail servers and bar servers out there that are busting their asses. And Kirby, half the time, is hanging out with his buds at St. Elmo's Bar and be like, Kirby, take off your apron. You're done. Go be with your buddies. You're not doing shit. This just cracks me up. That was the server inside of me getting a little frustrated with Kirby.
Let's just get into Kirby a little bit anyway.
Because Let's talk about
Emilio Estevez in this. And
yeah,
just
let's get into
his storyline.
Yes.
When I watched this the first time, it was almost to me the most interesting of the storylines because it's like, oh, he runs into the girl in college that he pined for and here's the second chance. And then it gets really creepy and overly obsessive. And I was like, I don't want to watch this anymore. This is horrible. And it gets to the point where Kirby gets this new job, decides to throw a party at this guy's house for this girl. Invites her. She says she might come. There's no guarantee, but he tells his friends this party is for her. And then she doesn't show up. He gets super, super pissed.
Loses his mind.
Yes. Drives out to where she is. I don't know what that was going to do. That's not going to help your case. And then at the end, she goes, oh, I was kind of flattered by your obsessiveness. And maybe I made a mistake. I'm like, what the fuck is this? Any normal girl would be like, restraining order. Don't get within 500 yards of me. I'm like, what is this? Even in the 80s. No. No.
It's ludicrous.
I got to give props to the boyfriend, though. He took this pretty well.
Oh, my God. He did. He was a cool customer.
Yeah, he was.
That aspect of it made more sense than anything because he came off as a real adult being like, oh, okay, this poor young boy, he's infatuated with my girlfriend, but he really has no chance. Like
that's a guy with confidence. He knows.
Yeah. And he's like, you know what? This kid's stuck up here in the wilderness in the snow and he's going to freeze to death. I'm just going to take care of this kid and make sure he's all right. And we'll see him on his way. He's no threat. He's no real threat. And it's like, oh, that makes sense. But you're right. Then when basically Kirby sweeps Dale off of her feet and kisses her, and all of a sudden she's under his spell for a moment. And oh my gosh, am I missing out on something? Am I really enamored with this young man in this moment? Whom, by the way, is only 3 to 4 years younger than her. It's not like a huge...
Right.
But I have so many different issues with this. It's like, no effing way. She would have called the cops on his ass days before that.
Yeah. It was the one storyline I was kind of looking forward to. And then I was like, no, I don't want to watch these two anymore.
So glad you actually said that very thing, because it was this storyline and the scene with Demi Moore when she has her nervous breakdown and she locks herself in her apartment. Mm-hmm. That scene I thought was going to be one of my favorite scenes for sure because of the heavy drama.
Right.
And that I was also looking forward to rewatching to analyze and be like, oh, yeah, this is a great scene. But again, watching this relationship before, Kerbo is a psycho in his pursuit of Dale. Yes. By the way, Dale Bieberman, great name. Great name for an older crush. Annie McDowell, beautiful in this. So I'm all about that. I liked this storyline as a younger man, too. It's like, yeah, go, Kirby. Go for the older girl, thinking like that she was in her 30s, but she's only four. She was a senior when she was a freshman.
Yep.
She's not that much older.
No.
So anywho, I was like, you go, Kirby. And I was like, yeah, he kissed her. He did it. Woo! And I'm watching it as an adult going, dude, what are you celebrating about, man? You should be in jail, bro. Like, you should, like, you're a stalker straight up. You've got some mental health issues.
Yes.
He acts like he's 14, not 21 or 22. Whether, you know, he's reserving a table at an expensive restaurant. There's like a very childlike aspect to it. Using Mr. Kim's limo to make him look as if he has money. Like, she'll fall for that.
Yeah, because he comes up with this idea that she only wants someone with money when she says the exact opposite. I'm like, are you not listening to her? That's one of the big things about a relationship, especially if you want to be with her. Listen to her.
And as if he became a millionaire overnight somehow. Yeah. And now he's being driven in a limo. By the way, the chauffeur, super cute. I was like, oh, yeah. This actress. She didn't do a whole lot after this, but it's like, she was great. Anyway. And then, of course, he drives up to the ski lodge in a total rage. Psychotic behavior. It's like, what?
Steals Wendy's car.
Yeah. Poor Wendy. So, yeah, at first it may appear cute, like his behavior, and she's reacting accordingly, but she's way too accepting and way too nice to him throughout. Because after the second or third attempt, she definitely would be like, okay, I am getting a restraining order, bro.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all too much. Totally different take on it today.
Yeah. Who else do you want to get into?
Well, we've beat up on Rob Lowe and his character of Billy Hicks a bit. I'm going to beat up on him a little more.
Okay, go for it.
If there was a performance, I might nick a little bit in this. I think Rob Lowe was, he was okay. There's some tough scenes. It's not all his fault. A lot of it's the writing. The scene between he and his wife, Felicia, in the park outside Georgetown University is pretty tough when he's telling her, I'm going to sober up and I'm going to get a job and it's going to be so much on the straight and narrow, it's going to be out of hand. That's like his signature expression in the movie. Things are going to get out of hand. It's a tough moment for him.
Well, he got a Razzie nomination for it, so.
Yeah. I want to like Rob Lowe. I love him and everything else. Rob Lowe's the man. Like, we can all agree on that, right? Rob Lowe's the freaking man.
Yeah.
Looks freaking fantastic still.
Yes, my wife, certainly. Jeez.
But even that scene, the dramatic scene with Demi Moore, she's just coked out of her mind. She lost her job as an international banker. She hasn't worked for 3 weeks. She got fired and all of her furniture has been repossessed. She's got nothing in her place and she's just sitting with the window wide open, freezing and kind of freaking out. And they break into her apartment. And now Billy comes to the rescue to have this wonderful heart-to-heart talk with her. And he talks about St. Elmo's fire back in the day, leading these sailors to safety or at least convincing them that there was some safety. And he doesn't even really describe what St. Elmo's fire is correctly after the research I did, but that's okay. It's the thought that counts. But he doesn't really reassure her. He's just like, you realize, see, the St. Elmo's fire that the sailors saw, that was all in their head. They were just making it up, just like you're just making this up. Like, dude, you're not helping. And all of a sudden, he is a little self-deprecating and she kind of laughs and they're like, oh, she's laughing. She's going to be okay. I'm like, no, she's not. She needs to go to rehab right now. Get her some real help because she's got some problems. And Billy is not the one to rescue her in this moment. It's like, holy shit, I have a totally different take as an adult watching this.
Yeah, I agree. That speech was terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Billy and Jules. Not to mention that he goes in to be the rescuer. Her savior. In the scene they had previous, he almost commits date rape.
Yep.
Or just plain out rape. Yeah. In the Jeep. He will not take no for an answer and keeps physically assaulting her, trying to have sex with her. She has to kick him out of her Jeep. And now she's going to accept him. Oh, well, that's just Billy. He's a drunkard and he is out of his mind. But now he's here for me. And he's the only one that will really get through to me in this moment. Bullshit. It's all bullshit. Sorry. Do you have any other complaints?
A ton, but I'll just do this last one.
All right.
Because I want to make sure we at least touch on every character in this. And I don't really have that much for Judd Nelson, but Andrew McCarthy as Kevin, who's pining for Leslie, but Leslie's with Alec, Judd Nelson. Dude, what are you doing? Because I get it. She's in a relationship and he knows that Alec is trying to get engaged and wants to marry her, even though he knows that Alec is cheating on the side, but every time he's around Leslie, he's such a downer. You're not giving any kind of signs that you're interested.
Right.
Not to say that you should, because she is in a relationship and I get that. But then Leslie finds out that Alex is cheating, and then Kevin pours his heart out and says he's been pining for all these years, and then they, you know, sleep together. And Leslie clearly realizes that was a mistake. It was a one night thing and that's it. And then Kevin becomes super obsessive, thinking all of a sudden now, because they slept together once, they're going to get married and they should move in together. I'm like, dude, once again, not reading the room.
Right.
He tries to kiss her all the time, and she's kind of like, don't, please don't.
And then he's like, yeah, we're going to be moving in together now.
Oh, man. It was awkward, and I felt really bad. That was kind of hard to watch.
That's a tough scene.
Yeah.
When she's basically got to tell him to leave because he's become overly obsessive himself in just such a short period of time. Yeah, those are the two problems I had with that as well. And it's unfortunate because Andrew McCarthy, obviously very likable as well, and likable through most of the film. I did not feel like he was giving off those vibes at all either, that he was in love with Leslie. He admits to Naomi, the prostitute, that he's in love with somebody, but she doesn't know. And then we're like, oh, okay, who is it? You can assume maybe it's Leslie, but then he's not really flirting with her or trying to vie for her attention.
He's doing the exact opposite.
Until she finds all the photos in his apartment of her, and then he's open about it. It's like, well, okay, I guess. And then all of a sudden, super obsessed. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. That doesn't flow.
Drop hints, but don't. It's wrong, but to even do that. But what he's doing is, it's even worse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was driving me up the wall.
Characters making bad choices.
Yeah.
All right.
Anything else?
No, that's it for me for now.
Okay, let's move on then. Two. Hey, it's that actor.
All right.
So in this segment, we spotlight a character actor you have seen in many other films, an actor making their big screen debut, or an actor that makes an uncredited cameo. It's Hey, It's That Actor. Who do we choose this week?
This week for our Hey, It's That Actor, we've chosen Blake Clark, who plays the role of Wally, owner of St. Elmo's Bar in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Good old Blake Clark. According to IMDb, he goes all the way back to 1980, where he did a lot of TV series and TV movies. I'm doing my Blake Clark voice, obviously, right now. He was in a couple of episodes of The Greatest American Hero. Oh, my God, I loved that show as a kid in the 80s. He was in an episode of MASH, an episode of Moonlighting, just to name a few. And then this in 85, he does more TV episodes where he appeared on Newhart, The Facts of Life, 7 episodes of Remington Steel, Give Me a Break, and it's Gary Shanley's show. He was Sheriff Monty and Johnny Handsome in 1989. After the 80s, he was Stenchy the Clown in the movie Shakes the Clown, highly underrated movie we watched in college. He was in a bunch of other movies, of course, but maybe best known as Farmer Fran from The Waterboy. Blake Clark was in a ton of Adam Sandler's movies. They are obviously buds, and he's great and very funny in a lot of Sandler's movies, as well as David Spade movies. He was also Harry the Hardware Store Guy on Home Improvement, if you remember that. Blake Clark also voiced Slinky Dog in Toy Story 3 and 4. He voiced Buford in Rango. He's done a lot of work recently, and it looks like, according to IMDb, Toy Story 5 is upcoming, so he'll be potentially reprising his voice role as Slinky the dog in that. Here's some fun facts about Blake Clark. He's been a stand-up comedian for over 2 decades and was featured on many a late-night talk show. This is great, and we thank you for your service, Blake Clark. He was a decorated infantry platoon leader in Vietnam. Clark brought the plight of the Vietnam veteran to the people of America in a humorous way in the 1980s and was adopted by numerous veteran organizations throughout the United States. His voice, you know, he's known for his voice and known for sounding much like the late actor Jim Varney. In fact, he was a close friend of the late Jim Varney, who voiced Slinky in the Toy Story movies, Toy Story 1 and 2. And then when Toy Story 3 went into production and Jim Varney had passed, well, Pixar came to Clark to take up the role of Slinky. Here's a funny comedic quote from Blake Clark. I was born and raised in Georgia and fought in Vietnam. It was like being punished for the same thing twice. In fact, I used to have flashbacks in Vietnam. Blake's now 77 years old with a couple of kids and still doing it. Blake Clark is our Hey, It's That actor this week.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like I've seen him forever.
For sure.
And I was surprised St. Elmo's Fire was his first film role.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great seeing him. Like, oh, there's that guy.
Yeah, especially from the Adam Sandler movies.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on to facts and trivia. What are some facts and trivia we have about St. Elmo's Fire?
All right, let's talk about the Brat Pack again real quick. I said we'd go into a little more detail, so here we go. David Blum's New York story, New York Magazine story, titled Hollywood's Brat Pack. That story ran on June 10th, 1985. It was originally supposed to be just about Emilio Estevez, but one night, Estevez invited Blum to hang out with him, Rob Lowe, Judd Nelson, and others at the Hard Rock Cafe. It was a typical night out for the group, who had gotten close while filming St. Elmo's Fire. That night, Blum decided to change the article's focus to an entire group of young actors at the time. The St. Elmo's Fire crew members did not like Blum and sensed that he was jealous of the actors' success. When the piece ran, the actors all felt betrayed, especially Estevez. The article mentioned people in several films, but focused on Estevez, Lowe, and Nelson and portrayed those three negatively. The Brat Pack label, which the actors disliked, stuck for years afterward. Before the article ran, they had been regarded as talented individuals. After the article, all of them were grouped together and regarded as unprofessional. Interviewed for Susanna Gora's 2010 book, You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, The Brat Pack, John Hughes, and Their Impact on a Generation, Blum admitted that he should not have written the article. With the increased negative attention to them, the actors then soon stopped socializing with one another. On the group's camaraderie, Ali Sheedy later said the article just destroyed it. I had felt truly a part of something, and that guy just blew it to pieces. There you go.
So Mayor Whittingham, who played Wendy, played the virgin in the film, and was actually pregnant during filming and married. So, yeah, she was playing against type. Nice job.
Good job, Mayor. The street that the St. Elmo Bar is on the Universal backlight. Two or three buildings to the left is the Hill Valley Clock Tower from Back to the Future.
Yeah, you could tell when they were on the... That's the one bad thing about doing a studio tour and going to those backlot sets. Like, it's so easy to notice now when you watch movies and go, oh,
yeah,
backlot.
Got it. It does take a little of the magic out of it. It's cool, yeah. But it isn't at the same time.
Yeah.
But if I ever do that backlot tour again, I want to look for that because you always see the clock towers like sticks out.
Oh, yeah.
But now I want to see if I can find St. Elmo Bar, if that's still there.
So here was a happy accident that made it on the film. So the shower scene between Andrew McCarthy and Ali Sheedy when the shower door fell, that was an accident, much to the surprise to both Ali and Andrew. And Ali's reaction was genuine. That's a real laugh because they did not expect that to happen. So happy accident that stayed in the movie.
That's great. I buy that. You can see that in the movie. Singer John Parr, who co-wrote and sang the title song St. Elmo's Fire for the soundtrack, explained during a speech at the Children's Choice Awards in Sheffield that he was not particularly thrilled to be working on this film and that the song was written in honor of Paralympian and fundraiser Rick Hansen. He said that the wheels of the Man in Motion reference, the lyrics, was popularly thought to mean the wheels of Demi Moore or Jules's Jeep, but actually refers to the wheels of a wheelchair.
Interesting. And that song did hit number one for 2 weeks in September of 85. So, yeah, it was a big song back then. So the name of the higher education campus that is seen in the movie is Georgetown University. All the major characters in the film storyline attended this university together. After reading the script, however, Georgetown University refused to allow producers to film on campus. So the on-campus scenes were filmed at the University of Maryland. Instead, no Georgetown University buildings appear in the film at all, except for a long shot from across the Potomac River.
Aha. Very good, then. Despite what Billy might say in this movie, St. Elmo's Fire, also called Witch Fire or Witch's Fire, is a weather phenomenon in which luminous plasma is created by a corona discharge from a rod-like object such as a mast, spire, chimney, or animal horn in an atmospheric electric field. It has also been observed on the leading edges of airplanes, as in the case of British Airways Flight 009 and by U.S. Air Force pilots. The intensity of the effect, a blue or violet glow around the object, often accompanied by a hissing or buzzing sound, is proportional to the strength of the electrical field and therefore noticeable primarily during thunderstorms or volcanic eruptions. And I guess St. Elmo's fire is named after St. Erasmus of Formia, also known as St. Elmo, the patron saint of sailors. So I guess St. Elmo is a real guy, huh, Billy?
No, not the character from Sesame Street.
That'd be great if that's where Elmo came from.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah. Bill Bant impressions, everybody.
All right, moving on to box office. St. Elmo's Fire was released on June 28th, 1985 in 1,204 theaters on an estimated budget of $10 million. It grossed $37.8 million domestically. It debuted number four at the box office behind the movie debut of Pale Rider, Cocoon, and Rambo First Blood Part 2. The movie would stay in the top 10 for only the next 4 weeks, but would jump back into the top 10 for 1 week in late September. St. Elmo's Fire would be the 23rd highest grossing movie in the U.S., just ahead of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Moving on to reviews, when growing up in the 80s, we would watch At the Movies with Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert to hear their reviews and watch clips of upcoming movies. Their review of St. Elmo's Fire was unanimous. Two thumbs down. Gene thought that the arrogance of the movie nauseated him, while Roger said it was the worst movie that any of the actors in the cast have made up to this point in their careers. St. Elmo's Fire was later spotlighted in their Worst Movies of 1985 episode. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a tomato meter score of 42% with an audience score of 68%. It also has an IMDb rating of 6.4. So that takes us to additional thoughts and questions. What are some additional thoughts and questions you have about St. Elmo's Fire?
You know, the song that the fictional band The New Breed is playing at St. Elmo's Bar in this movie features a sax solo by Billy.
Multiple.
That's a really, really, really long sax solo. It's like 3.5 minutes long. It's just an observation.
Yeah.
That is a long sax solo. He's just going and going and going. That's all. Just saying.
And then a guy sang maybe a verse and then back to sax solo.
Back to the saxophone.
Certainly. Since we're on Billy, do you really think he graduated college? I was like, how the hell did that happen? Never went to class, probably.
Yeah.
He was always partying. How the hell did he get through? Did Wendy do that for him?
He slept with his female teachers for grades, I guess.
That's a possibility. There's no way.
Yeah, I know. That's a good point.
I was like, how did he even get in? Georgetown's a good school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's a good point unto itself.
Like the other six make sense that they got. Well, Jules is kind of an international banker.
Yeah, yeah.
I could see five of the seven actually wanting to go to that school.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how Billy got through.
Yeah.
Sometimes one always slips through the cracks.
Yeah, that's true. We had some of those at our school too. So.
True. I got a question. How do we think Leslie actually did find out about Alex cheating?
Oh, yeah, I did want to ask about that. That was one of my questions. It just comes out of the blue. There's no clues or signs of it at all up to that point in the movie. And then she just kind of asks him or states it like she knows something.
Right. Because clearly Kevin didn't tell her.
Correct.
And it's one of those things where she kind of says, well, I just was suspicious or assumed it. And now you just confirmed it by admitting to it. But it appears as though she was informed, sure, she had some concrete evidence of some kind. So I was like, did Jules tell her? Did somebody tell her? Somebody know? I don't know. I was just curious. It's not that important.
Right. But at least it made sense of why he confessed, because he thinks that Kevin said something. So that right. Part I was usually, because usually when they kind of trick you into say something, you're like, come on, man, you're not that stupid. You're not going to figure that out. But mm-hmm. In that sense, because she has such conviction, Alec would be like, oh shit, fucking Kevin, I'm gonna kill him. Maybe something slipped or he said something. But the fact that she even says that statement to begin with, I'm like, where's this coming from? I mean, we know as an audience that you are, but we, of course, only think it was one person. And then we find out it was multiple. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
He's been dipping his wick a lot of places.
Alec, another not so good guy in this movie.
No, couldn't like him either.
Nah. Hey, Bill Bant.
Yes.
Where is the ski lodge that Kerbo drives to in order to find Dale?
Well, according to the research, it was in California.
Oh, okay. So he drove cross country, sure.
But in the movie, I'm not even sure where it's supposed to be.
This dude drove, man. There's like a wide shot, a master shot, like of the landscape. And you're like, oh my God, dude, did you drive 10 hours to get to the ski lodge? Which just reinforces psychotic behavior.
Right. Cause you think, okay, so if they're in Washington, D.C., and he leaves the party to get
there.
Does
he go north or south? I mean, is he going in
Virginia?
That's
a good question, too.
Where are these hills? I'm not familiar with the terrain nor ski lodging or.
Right. I'm not even.
Resorts on the east, northeast coast.
Cause yeah, there's certainly places in Pennsylvania, but if you're going south, I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe it would have to be Virginia. So that's a 2.5, maybe hour drive, 3 hour drive. And then the fact that he did it with no snow tires and chains even got that far.
Yeah.
That's right. Impressive.
I just think about that too.
And then that was like a 4 hour nap, gets up, and then, I mean, he doesn't make it back in time to clean up the party and loses his job, but.
Right. I actually had that. I was like, man, poor Mr. Kim striking out. I was like, why did he hire Kirby in the first place? Because we know that Alec somehow knows this Mr. Kim character.
Right.
And had gotten Billy a job as an assistant to Mr. Kim. But Billy was sleeping with one of Mr. Kim's, I don't know who the girl was.
I think that was a limo driver.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Super cute. So obviously Billy gets fired, but then Mr. Kim decides, oh, Alec, I'll take your recommendation again.
Yeah.
Hire one of your other friends, Kirby, who totally screws the pooch.
I'm surprised the limo driver still had a job.
Yeah.
Because even after the party, she's passed out on the couch. I was like, ew, not good.
What thoughts, questions do you have, my friend?
I think that's it for me. Yeah. I just hope Wendy's okay. That's all.
I only have one. Right. For sure. One more question. Did you, Bill Bant, ever have a Dale Bieberman crush on an older woman, perhaps?
That's a good question. So someone that was older or like someone from college? I know there was a girl in college that I don't even know who she was, but I would see her on campus all the time. And she reminded me of Belinda Carlisle.
Oh, great.
Yeah, sure. I thought she was super smoking. I think one of you guys did know her. I think I asked about her once, but she wasn't in our circle. Like super, I don't think I ever talked to her.
Yeah. I couldn't name anybody by name, but I've definitely had a Dale Bieberman or two that I've had a crush on. The older, more experienced ladies at that time, you know, in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, also even afterward, even post-college. Absolutely. I do not discriminate. I am not an ageist, but I couldn't tell. Yeah, I was just curious. I don't have just one in particular. One right. Dale Bieberman, but anywho. The wheels are turning.
Yeah, I don't think I have any restraining orders against me or anything like that. So I should be all right.
I remember in high school, the very first girl I technically dated was a senior, if I'm not mistaken. I was a freshman and she was a senior. So I definitely, I have an attraction to the older women for sure.
Yeah. So yeah, if you have crushes, just be careful of how you act upon it. That's our advice.
You know, interestingly enough, the girl I had a huge crush on, she was a senior, I was a junior. She was dating someone else. And I found that she was attracted to me as well, but and I was hoping that it would go further, but it didn't because she was being good. She was being faithful. And I got really upset by that. Like, why don't you just leave him? I was just a kid. Yeah, I don't know.
Right.
Just like, anyway.
All right.
All right, going down memory.
There goes the therapy portion of our show. Oh, yeah. One last thing before we get into reviews. So maybe by the time you listen to this episode, or it should be coming out soon, is Andrew McCarthy actually is coming out with a documentary called Bratz.
Oh, great.
Yeah, because he was very anti this Brat Pack label and then learned to accept it. So I guess the documentary is he goes and talks to all the other Brat Pack members just to talk about the influence and stuff like that. And he actually does interview David Blum.
Oh, awesome.
So it's supposed to come out in 2024. So if you actually listen to this episode when it came out, look for it. If you've listened to this down the road, it's already out. Try to find it. I think it might be Hulu. I think. But yeah, that is coming out. When I was doing the research and came across that, I was pretty excited.
That's great. See that one. And Andrew McCarthy's become quite the established director himself.
Yeah.
These days, so that's cool. Definitely will look forward to that. And one last additional thought now that you brought it up. That name, the Brat Pack, I didn't know for the longest time that it had a negative connotation. I never thought of it in that light for the longest time until I heard about the research. I just thought it was just a cute, clever take on the Rat Pack. You know, I was just like, yeah, that's the Brat Pack. And I was almost like, man, I wish I could have been part of that crew partying in LA and being in all these great movies during the 80s. It was like, oh, they got that name for the wrong reasons.
I don't know what I thought about that, to be honest, if I thought it was good or bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just knew when you said that, you know, who came to mind.
Right.
All right. So let's move on to our ratings. So on a scale of 1 to 5 Billy Joel records, and that includes The Stranger, what do you give St. Elmo's Fire?
I'm giving this 2.5 Billy Joel records. I wished I had more nice things to say, Bill Bent. But the movie is just not very good, in my opinion. I'd say it's worth watching to see these young stars in their heyday because they still have a certain charm. Again, I particularly liked Ally Sheedy in this. Mayor Winningham is winning in this. But outside of that, the movie doesn't have a lot of value for me now as an adult. It's not the worst movie of all time, but as Kirby was asking Kevin regarding what's the fluff in Fold and Fluff, well, this is just fluff. It certainly doesn't send a great message. If there's any message at all, I don't know. To end on a positive note, I still love the song Man in Motion by John Parr and love the love theme from David Foster's music. But yeah, so the music itself still gives me warm and fuzzy feelings for the 80s. And I'll leave it there. 2.5 Billy Joel records for me. What about you, Bill Band?
I'm right there with you. Once again, you hacked my computer. Yeah, 2.5. I think you said it best. It's interesting, but not good. And it's interesting just because of all the actors in it. Their storylines are not great. There's real no ending. Nothing's really resolved. They just kind of move on. We don't know if they've learned from their mistakes. But I couldn't stop watching it. I said watch 3 times. So I got through it and I wasn't like, oh man, I got to watch this again. I could get through it, but just 2.5.
Yeah, it just kind of holds your attention because you're like, oh, I want to see the cool kids do their thing. You're like, oh, they're not really doing a lot of good things.
Yeah, this movie certainly took a hit from the rewatch.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Yeah, it's one of those that did not stand the test of time for me.
I'm in agreement, and unfortunately or fortunately, I mean, that's just how it's going to go on this podcast. They're not all gems.
No.
All right.
I think that about wraps up for this week's episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. Please take the time to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Give us a review and rate us. If you want to learn more about our show, you can visit us at all80smoviespodcast.com. For our next episode, we will be discussing Family Business, starring Sean Connery, Dustin Hoffman, and Matthew Broderick. We hope you can join us. Have an excellent week, everyone.
Bill Bent. There are several quintessential moments in a man's life. Losing his virginity, getting married, becoming a father, and having the right girl smile at you. Thanks for staying up with us. Good night, world.